It being 10:30, I call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. We will begin with an approval of the minutes from February 16th, please.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the approval of the minutes from February 16th.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The minutes are approved. All right, today, first up, we will have House File 1030 by our own Representative and Chair Liebling. So we will move directly to the bill. We will, the motion, I believe, Representative Liebling, is to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. When you are ready, please proceed.
All right. Well, good morning, members. I am bringing before you House File 1030. It's been on our agenda a couple of times and got kicked over, and hopefully we can do this fairly quickly this morning. So House File 1030 is about cost barriers to health care. So I don't like to call it cost sharing, because cost sharing, you kind of think of sitting down and sharing the cost of a meal with your friends. That's not what this is. This is barriers to health care. This is how insurance shifts costs to the consumer, and often those costs are falling on the sickest consumers. So I looked and tried to find some data on out-of-pocket costs for people with health insurance. It isn't that easy to find really good information, but the Commonwealth Fund, which is a national organization, did a recent survey and found that 43% of working adults are inadequately insured in 2022. Some were uninsured, some had been uninsured for part of the year, and many, 23%, had coverage that didn't give them affordable access to health care. So these are national numbers. But there's also some data that shows that Minnesota has some of the highest out-of-pocket costs in the nation, well above the median for the country. So this is some information from the University of Minnesota that's showing that, and this might be a couple years out of date, I think it's 2022, also showing that Minnesota has the highest out-of-pocket spending in the nation. That's not how we think of ourselves. But what this out-of-pocket, these out-of-pocket costs do is set up a barrier to health care. Yes, they also possibly help reduce the cost of premiums so people can obtain health insurance. But when our constituents think about health care, they're not thinking about having insurance as much as they are thinking about having access to care that they can afford when they need it. And so that is really what this bill is meant to put a spotlight on. So the bill itself has different components. When I had this bill drafted, I think now a few years ago, I just asked to let's have a bill that would remove out-of-pocket cost barriers for every kind of insurance that Minnesota has jurisdiction over. Because I think that many of you know that we don't have jurisdiction over all health insurance. The so-called ERISA plans, the self-insured plans, which are quite a bit of our health care in the state, we do not have control over. But there are many things that we do. And so this bill has different sections to it. And the first of them is getting rid of the out-of-pockets in our medical assistance program. And medical assistance, as folks probably know, is for very low-income people. So I think it's up to 138% of the federal poverty level, generally speaking. So that's really low. And yet we have, in law, out-of-pockets that they are supposed to pay for various services. So the first thing that this does is to eliminate those. And I'm going to pause on that point because This year, the Department of Human Services has included that proposal in its budget proposal that is going to be before this committee. So if I was a small part of making that happen, I'm really thrilled about it, because this is something that really we should do. Because what we want is for people to go and get health care when they need it, so that they hopefully improve their lives and hopefully head off more serious illnesses by getting care or by getting the medications that have been prescribed for them and not setting up barriers. So even these small dollar amounts can be barriers. So I have with me today Ann Bobbs from the department, who is going to speak a little bit about the department's proposal that is also in this bill.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, and welcome to the committee, Ms. Bobbs, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. For the record, my name is Ann Bobbs. I'm with the Department of Human Services. As Chair Liebling mentioned, the provision to eliminate cost sharing in medical assistance in House File 1030 is included in the governor's budget. Currently, in medical assistance, some but not all enrollees are subject to cost sharing. Children and pregnant women, for example, are exempt from cost sharing. In addition, many but not all of our services have copays or a deductible applied to them. So for enrollees who are subject to copays, those copays can range from $1 to $3.50, depending on the service or prescription drug. The complexities in these copay policies can be confusing for enrollees and providers alike. Providers are the ones who collect copays. However, they cannot withhold services from an enrollee if that enrollee is unable to pay. So the elimination of copays and medical assistance will help support low-income families for whom these copays may be a financial burden. And we look forward to continuing to work with the chair on this bill throughout the course of session.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Bobbs. And we'll continue with your presentation.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not going to say a lot more about the bill, except to say that I realize that it may not be entirely practical to just implement all that is in the bill, but it is really meant to start the discussion about the meaning of having cost barriers when people buy insurance, pay a lot of money, often for premiums, and then still cannot get health care because they can't afford the out-of-pocket costs, or they incur a lot of medical debt in spite of being insured, which is also something that happens quite a bit. But I think very importantly, if people have out-of-pocket costs they know they have to pay when they're going to go and get health care, it deters people from getting the care. If your child is sick in the middle of the night and you don't know what to do and you're worried about your child, but you have to think, gee, am I going to be able to afford the copay? And what is my copay again? How much is this going to cost me? Am I going to be able to afford it? You may just decide to stay home with your sick child when you really ought to be taking the child into the emergency room. That's the kind of thing we want to prevent. And I'm going to stop there, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for the time.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, for the presentation. We'll go to testimony. We do have one person signed up, Mr. Dan Andreessen from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. If you could take a seat and state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, Trade Association for Minnesota's Nonprofit Insurance Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Our opposition is just in Section 2 of the bill. Our members cover a majority of the individual and small group markets, which will be impacted by the changes in Section 2. And so my testimony will focus on what will happen if a federal waiver is approved to prohibit cost sharing in these markets. So one of the main roles of health insurance is to help our enrollees access health care by financing and spreading out the costs of their annual health care bills. These costs are paid in one of two ways, either through premium dollars that are paid monthly by the enrollee, which then the health plan uses to pay medical bills, or through copays or coinsurance, which are paid before or after a health care service by the enrollee directly to the provider. Now, plans create a variety of products that divide the enrollee's payments between premiums and cost sharing, so they have a variety of different options that they can choose from. And as established in the Affordable Care Act, all products sale on the individual market must fall into one of four tiers. As you'll see in the table in our handout on our letter here, there's four tiers that all individual market plans have to fall into. And these are set by, or defined by a ratio of premiums to cost sharing paid by enrollees. And if cost sharing is prohibited, then all the products in these tiers will be eliminated, and the only product available will be one that's 100% premium. Now, there's no language in the bill to lower the cost of health care. If an enrollee is not paying their medical bills through cost sharing, the doctor is still charging you for that service. So that money will then have to come through premiums. And we expect those premiums are going to rise significantly. A single person could expect to pay $1,000 or more a month in certain parts of the state, and a family of four could be paying over $3,000 a month in premiums. And based on our experience, and they will have to pay this or go uninsured because choice has been eliminated. The market's going to go from four options to one. And based on our experience on platinum plans on the exchange, it's most likely that the 130,000 Minnesotans in the individual market will decide not to buy coverage. Initially, when the exchange began, some enrolled in platinum level plans. Platinum is a 90% premium, 10% cost sharing. But over time, fewer and fewer people purchased these plans because the premiums were so high. Eventually, no one bought these products, and they haven't been on the exchange for the last 5 years. If platinum products were set at 90% premiums and Minnesotans couldn't afford that, how are they going to afford 100% premiums? House Bill 1030, with inclusion of Section 2, would lead to unaffordable insurance rates, an increase in Minnesota's uninsured rate, and lead to an end to the individual and small group markets. Rather than the approach suggested in Section 2, we'd urge the committee to work to develop policies to address the cost of care, which is the root cause of healthcare unaffordability. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen, for being here, and thank you for your testimony. I just want to call out to the public, if there are any other individuals who would like to testify, this would be the moment. Seeing no hands, we will move to member questions and discussion. And Representative Carroll, you are first.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank the chair for bringing this bill forward. I worked in this area previous to my service here. I was with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office representing Metropolitan Health Plan, which is a public program's HMO. And I remember when this policy came through from DHS, the idea was to have enrollees have a little skin in the game and therefore value the care more. But what we found out soon was that it actually ended up as a prohibition or is administratively difficult. Oftentimes, health plans would just waive the copay or the pharmacy or whatever because it just wasn't worth the time and hassle to try to collect $1 or $3 and deny people care. So I appreciate you bringing this forward, and I'll be supporting it.
Thank you, Representative Carroll. Any comment, Representative Liebling?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's really all. We could just, I think, lay over the bill. Or I think I see another question.
Sure. But, yeah. All right. Thank you. Representative Guam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author and committee members. I watched closely when PPACA passed federally and the evolution, and I remember bragging about, not myself, but there were people and entities bragging about how low Minnesota premiums were. And you know me, I did the math, and I looked at cost of premiums, cost of out-of-pocket, and then looked at the copays. And when I compared to what was happening in other states, the total cost wasn't better in Minnesota. It was just shifted from premiums to out-of-pocket and copays. And that's why, you know, medical expenses are pretty high. And this bill has a good intent, but I don't see it lowering the effective cost. So we get rid of the out-of-pocket and that, we're going to end up with a program that is premium-wise so expensive that we'll go back up and have more people uninsured because, frankly, they see it as, you know, budget-wise, cash flow-wise better to just bank and then pay for the medical expenses directly. Because I, over the last decade, I've heard a lot of that. I've heard a lot of people going to the cooperative medical because of the structure of some of these plans. So I understand the intent. I fear the reality would be detrimental.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank Chair Liebling for bringing this bill forward. The committee may remember that I have a bill removing cost sharing for breast cancer screening, and it's that way because those high out-of-pocket costs can become a barrier to care. And so I just really appreciate the broad scope that this has and the intent of the bill. So thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Representative Schumacher.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Process question first for the chair. The bill is being laid over today. Section 11 of the bill requires the Commissioner of Commerce to request a waiver. This also impacts our CEGA programs. Will the Commerce Committee or State Government Committee be hearing this language at some point?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Schumacher, if the bill was going to move forward in its current form, then yes, but we'll see if that happens.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Nadeau.
Yes, sorry. As for you, Dan. I heard you.
That was passed for me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think this is an awful idea. And I guess I want to go on the record talking about it. If we're talking about, you know, reducing a few bucks here and there on a copay, hey, no problem. But that's not what I read this bill to be. I mean, this is going to, you know, eliminating cost sharing for, you know, all products offered on the individual and small markets for small businesses. I mean, it's truly going to drive costs up. I mean, you know, the platinum plans that were offered before that had the lowest copays, nobody bought them because the premiums were too high. So the idea here, I think, is fine. I mean, if we want to eliminate out-of-pocket costs for our MA populations, great. Let's figure out a way to do it. Let's get a fiscal note. Let's identify it, and let's do that. But this is almost, it's on the edge of ridiculous. You know, this will drive up our uninsurance rates. This will drive costs for consumers. It's cost prohibitive. It goes the absolute opposite direction that Minnesota has gone forever to provide care in a cost-effective way with our partners in from providers to health plans to everyone else. So, I mean, to be in favor of this, I mean, this is a massive increase in our health insurance premiums, and I just don't understand why we're going here. If we're trying to solve some out-of-pocket cost expenses for our lowest income people, fantastic. Let's get there. This is far beyond that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. We have Representative Murphy, Bonner, and Ryer, and then we will go to closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just make a couple comments. I think this is going to be terrible for small businesses and self-employed people. I come from that background. I can tell you my story. 10 years ago, it was a situation where I had a $10,000 deductible myself. And then my cost for my premium was $3,000 a month. And that year, one of those years, I used it all. So before my first dollar of care, I had $46,000 out of my pocket for this. But this is going to destroy small businesses and self-employed people because that premium is going to go up. They're going to have to look for another option. We did. We went to a co-op sharing and removed ourselves from insurance. But this is going to hurt small businesses and self-employed people a lot. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. I just want to say thank you to Chair Liebling for bringing this bill forward. You know, it's interesting that just within the last week we saw some data out of the White House that said that during the pandemic when we had opened up and expanded insurance coverage to more Americans, that within that time frame, we saw a steep decline in the reductions of medical debt across the country, which is one of the largest segments of U.S. debt. So I think that's really telling. And why it relates to this, and I think specifically, is that we have here a bill that talks about barriers to care, and specifically preventative care. What we really know from the data on the ground, from the facts, and the health plans know this too, is that when we get access to preventative care, the overall cost goes down. And it goes down because people are not putting off critical care that they should be receiving, that they should be going to the doctor for, and waiting until it's too late, when the ramifications of that care are significantly, or that condition are more acute, they are more costly to treat, and more challenging. And not only that, the bills get bigger, folks. When the bills get bigger and more people are suffering from medical debt, that does not help the system. It doesn't help insurance companies. And we talked about, you know, the total cost of ownership, and I thank Representative Kwan for that, because that's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about shifting. And I can tell you, you know, for small businesses and for companies, and we talk about these bills or these items with the high deductibles, people are not going to get care because of high deductibles. That is not helping anyone when we don't go get care. I can tell you, for decades, I put off care because the deductibles were so high. And small businesses, to be honest with you, I have a constituent who told me that their small business was paying $10,000 to $15,000 in deductibles on their high deductible plan for her and her husband. That is insane. I don't know how small businesses continue to operate if they have to spend $15,000 on receiving care. But specifically, this bill does a great deal to talk about MA. We are talking about people who have legitimate, real reasons to have barriers to care. We're talking a dollar here, $3 there. In the grand scheme of things, in order to make sure that people are getting good preventative care and we can bring costs down, it is silly to be arguing over such small and minute amounts. So I want to thank Chair Liebling for bringing this bill forward, and I am hopeful that this might bring reduced barriers to care and get folks the preventative care that they need.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Next, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, people talk about $1 to $3 to $5 copays being small. I've been the person for whom that isn't the case. I've been the person on medical assistance who found that to be a significant barrier for me and for my small son at the time. Also, as a long-term researcher in the healthcare space, I have talked to many, many small businesses, large businesses, individuals who use healthcare and who purchase healthcare. And the consistent theme I hear and have heard for decades about small business is that the market does not serve them as it is, and the barriers to care are real. So I thank you for this.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Final words, Representative Lee.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for your comments, committee members. So a few things I would like to point out. First of all, you know, people talking about cost of care, you know, you can't do everything in one bill, right? Healthcare, as we all know, is very complicated. We do have to tackle the actual cost of care, but can't do everything in one bill. So this bill is not aimed at that underlying issue. People take on the high, when people have to choose plans and they have to balance their out-of-pocket cost against the cost of the premium, oftentimes people with lower incomes are forced to take the cheaper plans. They're forced because they can't afford the high cost of the premiums, and so they kind of bet that they're not going to need to spend a lot out of pockets. And unfortunately, sometimes they lose the bet, hence we've got all the medical debt and so on. We do right now have the Biden subsidies. I want to remind people, the cost of premiums is reduced under the Biden subsidies. So I think it's 8% of your income is the most on the exchange that you have to pay for premiums. So right now at least, if the cost is shifted to premiums, that there is help with that. And I hope people listening realize that, that it has brought that down. But Minnesota still does have the highest out-of-pocket spending. So is it ridiculous to think that we should bring that down? I don't think it's at all ridiculous. Having, I think, was Representative Murphy said $46,000 in out-of-pocket costs? That's outrageous. That should never happen to anyone. When you have insurance, that should never, ever happen. So, I don't think it's ridiculous at all to think that we should find a better way to make sure that people can get actual health care. Having a policy does you no good if you can't get health care when you need it. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would ask to have the bill laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. We will take a very brief comment from Representative Murphy.
Thank you. My comment to that is that the decision we had to make that year when we had the high deductible or the low deductible and high premium, because it was the cheapest way we could afford to stay in business. We had to pick the premium that we could live with. And so what this is going to do, in my opinion, is this is going to drive those premiums up even higher and will force people out. And actually, that's what happened to us. We couldn't afford $46,000. I'm not bragging about the $46,000. No business can afford it. But that's what you're going to do if you drop the options, and we're going to have higher premiums. And that's going to drive people out.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Thank you, Representative Liebling, for House File 1030 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. So our next bill, as we change chairs, will be House File 100, Representative Stevenson.
All right, welcome to the committee, Representative Stevenson. The chair will move that House File 100 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. And I would like to remind people as we get started with House File 100 that we only have jurisdiction over part of the bill, and we're going to limit remarks to the committee's jurisdiction. And also, I know this can be a contentious bill, and just want to remind folks that we need to maintain decorum in the committee room, and no clapping or outbursts will be allowed. So we have 20 testifiers on the bill. So Representative Stevenson, welcome, and to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In light of the number of testifiers, I'm going to be exceptionally brief, especially since many of you have seen this bill before. This is the bill to legalize adult-use cannabis. Minnesota's current laws are doing more harm than good. Minnesotans deserve the freedom and respect to make their own decisions about cannabis. And I look forward to a complete discussion today, and I'll be happy to answer questions after the testifiers.
All right. Very good. Representative Stevenson, thank you. So first on our list, we welcome former Governor Jesse Ventura. Governor, welcome to our committee. We're so honored to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I've admitted that in the last 2 weeks, I've spent more time in this building and the Senate building than I think I spent my entire 4 years as governor. I don't think I got over to either one of those buildings ever. You all came to me mostly. I didn't have to come to you, but thank you for allowing me to be here today. I'm here because I guess this all started with me. Back when I was governor, I was the first person to bring forward that it was time to legalize cannabis marijuana and take our heads out of the sand and get into reality. I'm going to tell you two stories in my support of legalization of cannabis. First story is this. My life was gone. Cannabis saved my life. I want to repeat that. Not me personally, but it saved the 38th First Lady of Minnesota, my wife of 47 years. About a decade ago, she was inflicted with late-in-life seizure disorder. In other words, the First Lady was seizing 2 to 3 times a week, and these were the kind of seizures you were helpless. Lying on the floor, making sure she's not swallowing her tongue and she keeps breathing, and everything you do, we were helpless. What did we do? We went naturally to medicine. She was put on 4 different seizure medicines, one after the other, after the other, after the other. None of them worked. They all had horrible side effects, but guess what? Insurance would pay for them all, happily. Everything that didn't work. In desperation, we had heard about the success cannabis and marijuana was having with seizures. We drove to Colorado. We had friends there from Mexico that we knew and were forced to break the law. They went in and bought the 3 drops under the tongue. I might add, the First Lady, the night before we got there, she seized in the motel. We got there. They went in and bought them, gave it to her illegally. She started the 3 drops under the tongue, and I can happily say she has not had a seizure since. Now, we came home to Minnesota, and I was forced to do what one of my idols said, Dirty Harry Callahan, when he made the quote, well, then the law's wrong, because I had to make a decision between Minnesota law or my wife. Well, guess what? My wife won. I broke Minnesota law. We started receiving cannabis from our friends in Colorado, kept my wife seizure-free until medical was approved here. My wife then went down, was top on the list, got approved. She now gets it in pill form, but here's the problem. $600 a month. Insurance won't pay for it. Nobody will. That's almost a mortgage. I almost left the state of Minnesota and moved to Colorado because of that, because it was costing me $600 a month to keep the First Lady of Minnesota seizure-free. Now, why? Because you were so restricted. You've expanded now. It's dropped to $300 a month. Like good capitalism, if you allow it to work its way through, the prices of capitalism will drive it down to where it will be affordable for everyone. $600 a month is not affordable for everybody. I'm lucky. I could afford it. Almost moved, though, because of it. Second part of my story. I saw in the Star Tribune there's a big debate on what age. And the medical experts claim 25 should be the age to use cannabis, marijuana. Well, now you're going to hear my story. At 18 years old, I enlisted in the United States Navy way back when, 50 years ago or more. I spent 1 year, turned 19, in the most physically tough training the U.S. military has. That's BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL. I became a Navy SEAL at 19 years old. I then deployed to Vietnam and Southeast Asia for a 9-month deployment where I turned 20. I then came back to the United States, my country. I had been back 1 week when I walked into my executive officer and demanded I be sent back to Vietnam immediately. Why did I say that? Here's why. Because over in Vietnam, I was an adult and I was a man. Back in my own country that I came back to, I was a child. I couldn't go up the street and buy a beer. I wasn't 21. I couldn't even vote for who sent me to Vietnam because the voting age at that time was 21. So therefore, I learned from that, what do? We send children to war. Isn't that child abuse? The point I'm making for you people, elected officials, is this. End the hypocrisy. Pick an age of adulthood and don't pick it out that makes it convenient. If you're 18 and you can go and die for your country or kill for your country, you certainly are old enough to smoke a joint, if you want one. Think about that a minute. Your country says you can go die and kill for it. I face post-traumatic stress today. You know what it's over? That. The fact that I was sent over and my country labeled me a child. When I came back, I didn't get the privileges of being an adult. I was underage. So when you hear him talk about, oh, you should be 25, well, I'll counter that to these doctors and say, how old do you have to be to go kill or be killed on behest of your government? It seems 18 works there, doesn't it? Right? Come on. 18, right? So why would marijuana be 25? I think killing or being killed for your government is far more important than that. And I'll finish with this. Throughout my life, I've done alcohol and I've done marijuana. I'm a product of the 60s. And I can assure you, I've misbehaved far more on alcohol than I ever have on marijuana. In fact, I only misbehaved twice that I can recollect on marijuana. You know what I did? Back in 1970 on marijuana, I went and saw Jimi Hendrix, and then a couple months later, Janis Joplin. I admit it. I was on pot when I went there. And I'll tell you, it was one hell of a show. I still remember it today. July the 28th, 1970, I saw Jimi Hendrix live. But the point I'm getting to is this. Pick the age, people. Why do you think everyone's so unhappy with government today? Because of hypocrisy. On one hand, you're an adult, and on the other hand, you're a child. I think if you can kill on behest of your government or be killed at the behest of your government, that's the age of adulthood. I know I was an adult. I looked at my commanding officer that day, my XO, and I said, sir, I'm no longer a child. I am an adult. Why is my country treating me like I'm a child?
Governor?
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here today.
And thank you for listening, and I hope you'll take that under due consideration. Think about those ages.
All right.
For a moment.
Thank you, Governor.
Thank you.
All right. The next testifier is on the list is Kayla Fearing. And I'm going to just say, although unless you're a former governor of the state of Minnesota, you're going to be limited to 2 minutes. So.
Let me apologize for that a moment, Madam
not
Chair.
Not at all. Wait. Not at all, Governor. We're happy to have you.
I remember my first week in office, we were late. And I turned to my security and said, oh, we're going to be late. And my security looked back at me and said, Governor, remember, the governor's never late. Everyone else is just early.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. And then after Kayla Fearing is Linda Stanton on deck. So please be ready. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony. And we'll be timing and just let me apologize in advance to everyone that we have to do that, but we do have to get through the bill. So welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and House of Health and Finance. My name is Kayla Fearing, and I am a small business owner of Healing Fear Consulting, which specializes in healthcare science-based cannabinoid education. I've been a healthcare worker for 15 years. The last 3 years, I have worked in Michigan and Illinois cannabis markets. I've learned a lot from the Midwestern states. But most importantly, I've learned that cannabinoids need to be incorporated into all aspects of medicine. My educational background is in kinesiology, and ironically enough, with the minors in pre-addiction studies and leadership from the University of Minnesota. I have completed the St. Paul Fire Department's Emergency Medical Services Academy back in 2014. I am a daily cannabis user. I am a Michigan medical patient because even though I was born and raised in St. Paul, Minnesota, I have not yet qualified for the Minnesota medical program. I've had three reconstructive surgeries on my left leg, and I've had a third of my right lung removed back in 2019, all before turning 30 years old, amongst mental health diagnoses as well. Cannabis helps me have the most meaningful quality of life as a healthcare worker and a patient. I currently hold no medical licenses, and I'm doing that so I can testify to say that cannabinoids need to be acknowledged in medicine and by healthcare workers. The last dispensary I worked at was 25 minutes west of Detroit, Michigan. We were an extremely conservative county, and we averaged 1,400 people a day. About 30 people a week were Minnesotans driving to Michigan to access affordable medicine for themselves. Most of the patients I personally work with are those with athletic careers, autism disorders, Alzheimer's and dementia, as well as addictions like opioids and alcoholism. We cannot limit natural occurring cannabinoids in our patients and natural occurring cannabinoids that come from the cannabis plant. CBN, CBG, CBC, THCA, et cetera, all deserve to be legalized within HF 100, not just CBD, not just THC. As lawmakers, it is your responsibility and our responsibility to educate you on terpenes and cannabinoids. Everybody uses cannabinoid products, whether you're an officer, a teacher, clergy, everybody uses cannabis. And to quote the governor, if the law is wrong, or if it's against the law is wrong. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Linda Stanton, and next on deck is Amber Shimpa. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to my testimony today. You only have one brain. Take care of it. Making THC legal won't make it a safe drug. Over the decades, the plant has been cultivated so one can get high much faster, and thus it's more addictive, unlike Governor Ventura when he used pot when it was at 3%. Cannabis today that's extracted can be 50 to 90% potent. There's no positive public health purpose for legalization of recreational marijuana. The bill moves cannabis from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. It's like taking it from a locked cabinet and putting it on a park bench. Schedule 1 includes drugs like heroin. According to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, these drugs have a high potential for abuse, no currently accepted medical treatment use in the U.S., and lack an accepted safety, have a lack of accepted safety for use under medical supervision. Under what medical authority does the state legislature feel they are qualified to make this determination? Regulating cannabis and THC won't change the psychoactive or mind-altering properties of the drug. It will just give people the false sense that it's safe. According to medical reports, at least three preschool-aged kids have died from THC poisoning. Reports show that marijuana is involved in more than one of every road deaths in Colorado. I was thinking over the amount of testimony that's already been provided by the many committees. I hope you will review it all. Police chiefs and associations, Chamber of Commerce, Hazelden, MDs, PhDs, parents, NAMI, and community members, all either opposing or pleading for extreme caution, like setting a potency cap so people would be less likely to get addicted and become psychotic, setting cannabis apart from alcohol and nicotine by making the legal age 26 because the brain is not done developing before then. Follow the science, not Governor Ventura. How many children need to be poisoned and how many people need to die in car accidents before we get an acknowledgement that cannabis isn't a safe drug? Stop now and vote no. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Amber Shimpa, followed by Trent and Jane Mayberry. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Amber Shimpa, and I'm the CEO of Vireo Health of Minnesota, one of the two medical cannabis licensees. For the past 8 years, it's been an honor to lead our team while serving over 40,000 patients with care and compassion. Although there are many positives in this bill, we do believe it falls short in a few areas. First, the current bill would terminate our medical license on July 1 of 24. It does not offer a reasonable path to protect our current and future patients from disruptions to their care after July 1 of next year. We are grateful for Senator Port for the amendment that was adopted today to remove this date, and it provides patients then with continuity of care that they need and deserve. Second, the bill limits growing space for medical cannabis. We currently have more than double the bill's proposed space to meet the needs of the current patient base. And third, the bill bars medical cannabis companies from growing, processing, and dispensing medical cannabis. No other state in the country bars vertical integration for their medical program because it would result in higher costs to patients. And if vertical integration is barred, Vireo would be forced to wind down various aspects of our operations. And we proudly employ more than 200 Minnesotans, many of which are 1189 UFCW union members. We also believe the bill should establish an adult use program that provides safe, quality, and tested cannabis at affordable prices to combat the illicit market. The bill falls short here. First, the bill requires that medical and adult use cannabis be grown and retailed separately. No state in the country does this. And pursuing this path in the Minnesota program will make it easier for the illicit market to thrive and increase costs in any legal market. And second, The bill should aim to create an environment where all of us stakeholders can contribute to a successful program. It's not zero sum, and this current bill has a reasonable chance of putting us out of business. So let's be stewards together and build a program that supports emerging, diverse cannabis entrepreneurs and longstanding Minnesota business. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Trent and Jane Mayberry, followed by Raymond Hicks. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Trent Mayberry. I'm here to share my family's story. Unfortunately, this is a tragedy about how cannabis, a supposedly harmless plant, led my daughter, Catherine Mayberry, to die at the age of 24 last October. Catherine was a perfect kid up until age 18. She was an honor student, worked two jobs as a teenager, including being a lifeguard, played varsity tennis, rec softball, and founded a badminton club. She played piano and won awards for her artwork. In 2016, at the age of 18, Catherine went off to college and was never the same. Over a two-year period, Catherine began regular use of cannabis. She dropped out of college, her personality changed, and she became withdrawn. She was, no doubt in my mind, addicted to cannabis. She then experienced her first episode of psychosis in the fall of 2018 at the age of 20. At that point, Catherine's brain was permanently damaged from cannabis use. She was in a catatonic state and was admitted to inpatient facilities at Fairview and Regions. Over the next 4 years, Catherine suffered from continuous auditory hallucinations, delusional thinking, slowed mental capacity, and extreme anxiety. Antipsychotics did not help her because they aren't effective at treating cannabis-induced psychosis. She lost all her friends, her prospects for college and career gone. She lived in 24-hour staff subsidized housing, and even menial work was too much for her. Yet she continued to use cannabis and began self-medicating with alcohol and increasingly harder drugs. In October of last year, Catherine died from an accidental drug overdose of meth laced with fentanyl. My wife and I saw firsthand how cannabis destroyed our daughter's life. Permanent psychosis is worse than death, believe me. Please add the following guardrails to your bill. One, require package warnings that inform the consumer cannabis use may cause psychosis, which may be permanent. Two, require an age restriction of 25 because of brain development for our youth. And three, require a THC potency cap. Again, thank you for allowing me to share Catherine's story.
Thank you for your testimony. Raymond Hicks, followed by Glenn McElfresh. Welcome to the committee.
I'm Ray Hicks. I brought a picture that just shows my family 21 years ago when Jay was 3.5 and Kyle was 2.5. On the back side of this is Jay's grave marker. And cannabis played a significant role in his death. By the way, our boys were both special needs boys from South Korea. Jay had mental health issues that worsened as he grew. He suffered from borderline personality disorder. We sought much help for him, yet it got worse in middle school. His cannabis use increased then. Mental health episodes became frequent and intense. Academic performance declined sharply. Self-medicating is common in people suffering mental disorders. Jay turned to cannabis for this purpose. The effects on him were devastating. Cannabis harms brain development even into the 20s and has serious effects on mental health. Cannabis didn't help Jay's problems. It led him to deadlier substances. On June 3rd, 2019, he got one laced with fentanyl and it took his life at age 21. Cannabis is not safe for human consumption, as some claim. It may relieve some symptoms. It does relieve some symptoms, but it worsens many conditions dramatically. It damages brains, especially among our young. It greatly increases the chance a person will turn to more dangerous drugs. This bill, the way it's written, legitimizes non-medical adult use of cannabis. It makes cannabis more attractive to our children and young people. It will lead to more people to use it. Even restricted to age 21 and up, it will be in more homes where some children will get access to it. I appeal to common sense and concern for people, especially our youth, asking you to stop this bill the way it is. Making it law will increase drug-related deaths and grief. If we are adults, we should act like it. Kill this bill, not people.
Thank you for your testimony. Glenn McElfresh, followed by Carrie Oldfield-Tabbard. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Liebling, committee members, and Representative Stevenson, thank you for allowing me to speak today on HF 100. My name is Glenn McElfresh, and I'm a co-founder of Plift, a hemp-derived beverage company. I spent the first months of 2020 writing an Illinois craft grower application with my uncle, who is black and a social equity applicant. We received high marks in 9 of the 10 scoring categories, but did not score veterans points. My uncle could not enlist because he is gay and too old to enlist when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. The only category of points HF 100 doesn't share with Illinois' adult use marijuana law is awarding points for being an Illinois resident. The other 9 scoring categories, including awarding points for being a veteran-led application, are the same. Veteran-led groups won all the initial round of dispensary and craft grower licenses in Illinois. A few moments ago, Governor Ventura spoke about the high prices of Minnesota's medical marijuana program. Illinois' 21 medical marijuana cultivators had nearly 15 times as much canopy as Minnesota's 2 medical marijuana manufacturers, yet Illinois patients complained about increased prices and lack of product selection when adult-use marijuana launched. If Illinois is any indication of Minnesota's future, and I believe it is, medical marijuana prices will increase and product selection will decrease in spite of the medical marijuana manufacturers' best efforts otherwise. There's simply not enough plants in the ground to serve the adult use and medical marijuana markets, and access to medical marijuana will move further out of reach for lower and middle-income Minnesotans. Likewise, thousands of excited Minnesotans will wait in line for hours at a currently unspecified but extremely limited number of retailers for a limited number of extremely expensive adult-use marijuana products that likely will cost nearly 5 times more than the products they can currently buy today. If HF 100 becomes law, Minnesotans can expect a longer drive to find these products, increased prices, and more empty shelves. We've heard previous expert testimony that Minnesota's adult-use market would require an additional 600,000 square feet of indoor canopy to meet recreational marijuana demand. I do not know if that number includes the current demand for medical marijuana. Based on publicly available data, which I acknowledge may not be entirely up to date, Minnesota's 2 medical marijuana manufacturers have approximately 250,000 square feet of canopy between their cultivation facilities. As we've heard from their patient testimony, the 2 medical marijuana manufacturers are doing all that they can to serve more than 40,000 medical marijuana patients, but our patients are still hurting. I applaud the 2 medical marijuana manufacturers, but forcing 2 businesses to serve the entire adult use market for an unknown period of time is concerning. We need more accurate canopy estimates to better serve Minnesota's medical and adult use marijuana markets.
I have to ask you to wrap up. Okay, thank you very much. Carrie Oldfield-Tabbard. Followed by Carter Casimir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Oldfield-Tabbert, and I am the director for the Local Public Health Association, or LPHA. LPHA works with more than 240 public health directors, supervisors, and community health administrators from local health departments across all 87 counties, as well as cities and tribes. Local public health works each day to protect and promote health in our communities, including preventing adverse health outcomes before they occur. If cannabis is legalized in Minnesota, we want to ensure a focus on health, safe use for adults, and youth use prevention. We already work on preventing youth commercial tobacco use and alcohol use in our communities and can play a similar role for youth cannabis use. I'd like to specifically speak to the A51 amendment that's in front of you.
Yeah, that's not before us right now, so we'll call you back to testify on that when we get to amendments.
All right. Well, I will just keep this brief then and just say that we have a pulse on our communities and really can focus on and speak to youth prevention and community needs, and really look forward to working with you to protect health as this bill moves forward.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Carter Kastmayer, followed by Jess Hauser. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Let me first thank the members of the committee for their attention to the very important matter of cannabis legalization. My name is Carter Kasmer, and I'm a physician specializing in emergency medicine. I've cared for acutely ill and injured patients in some of our region's largest, busiest medical centers, in addition to rural critical access hospitals across our state. The nature of our work demands that we're experts in recognizing and treating medical emergencies. You may be asking yourself, what do these physicians think of the threat posed to the community by cannabis use? Shorter answer is we don't. We simply don't have time to worry about patients ingesting a plant devoid of any real toxicity and which requires no antidote in the uncommon instance that an individual's overindulgence drives them to seek medical attention. We're far too busy caring for patients suffering from the acute effects, accidents, injuries, and myriad chronic illnesses that accompany the use of legal, widely abused drugs such as alcohol and the public health crises posed by opiate and methamphetamine addiction. We do, however, worry about the manner in which our most vulnerable patients' health is compromised by barriers to obtaining housing and employment, in the form of prior convictions for nonviolent crimes, including possession of cannabis. Consider the many ways the communities you serve, and particularly the minorities within them, are harmed by a poorly informed status quo that makes criminals out of thousands of otherwise law-abiding citizens. Is this the future that you envision for our state? Under federal law, cannabis remains classified as Schedule I, equally dangerous as heroin and more dangerous than cocaine, methamphetamine, and prescription opiates and sedatives. The error in this classification is glaring and immediate, and to anyone in the medical community, the credibility of those who believe this to be true is questionable at best. Please use this opportunity before you to demonstrate that you will not be swayed by misinformation and that you are capable of instituting the sensible and progressive policies around cannabis legalization that a majority of citizens in our state clearly desire. Cannabis prohibition has failed. What we need now are elected officials unafraid to take bold action to fully legalize cannabis. We need healthcare professionals who possess the requisite knowledge to guide their patients and the public in using cannabis responsibly. And we need citizens to embrace safe use practices, including safe storage of cannabis products away from children. I come before you today as one of the vast numbers of medical professionals who support the full legalization of cannabis in our state. Let us move past the fear and the ignorance that has defined cannabis prohibition, and let's commence with building a more just, healthy, and prosperous future for all of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Jess Hauser, followed by Angela Dawson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Thank you, committee. My name is Jessica Hauser, and I'm mom to Wyatt, the first patient registered with Minnesota's medical cannabis program. He's 10 years old and participated in the cannabis program for 7 years. Medical cannabis was an important part of his treatment for a rare form of epilepsy called Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. We left the program when we were able to transition him to Epidiolex, a cannabis-based medication that is covered by our health insurance. Access to the Minnesota Medical Cannabis Program helped improve his quality of life and is a safe and effective option for children with seizures and many other medical conditions. While I'm very supportive of HF 100 for a variety of reasons, I want to ensure that children who are currently medical cannabis patients continue to have access to high-quality cannabis products and that it is easier for families to choose and access medical cannabis as a treatment for pediatric patients in the future. It's a beneficial treatment option for everything from autism to epilepsy to chronic pain, not only for adults, but also for kids. Having reliable cannabis-based therapy is an important option for parents as it's a treatment with a low profile of side effects and may be more readily available when we see pharmaceutical shortages. To help ensure the voice of pediatric patients and parents is represented as this new law moves forward, please ensure that a parent or caregiver of a pediatric patient is included in the advisory board to the Office of Cannabis Management. There needs to be a clear legal path for access for patients that are under 21. My other hope is that this new legislation brings down the cost of medical cannabis. While Wyatt was a patient, we spent more than $10,000 on the cost of fees and medications. No Minnesotan should have to choose between the cost of their medicine and being a criminal or going without. Children are an important part of this patient group. It's been nearly 9 years since the initial law was passed in 2014, and it's long past time to improve access to safe, affordable cannabis including medical cannabis in Minnesota. Thank you for your time and for supporting HF 100.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Angela Dawson, followed by Stephanie Mulrooney. Okay, is Angela Dawson here? Okay, I don't see anybody coming down, so we'll go to Stephanie Mulrooney.
Hello, my name is Stephanie Mulrooney. I reside in Northeast Minneapolis and I'm a medical cannabis patient. The start of my difficult journey began in July of 2013 when I was in a serious collision. I suffered broken bones requiring multiple surgeries over the span of 2 years. In addition, I underwent years of physical and occupational therapy. While trying to get physically better, I was struggling with cognitive issues. I suffered migraines, short-term memory loss, and severe sensitivity to light and noise. I was easily confused, anxious, and could not articulate my thoughts and words. After numerous diagnostic tests, I was diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury, PTSD, as well as chronic pain and fatigue. I lived and continue to live with medical issues on a daily basis and likely will for the rest of my life. Initially, I was prescribed multiple strong pain medications such as Dilaudid and oxycodone. These medications made me feel very sick and increased my anxiety, so I switched to over-the-counter pain medications. I began mixing over-the-counter pain medications and was taking 10 to 15 pills a day. My pain was daily, debilitating, and making it impossible to enjoy a normal life. As a result, I lost my career as a computer programmer. Many days, I couldn't even get out of bed, and I sunk into a depression. Some days, I would think I couldn't live like this, and I didn't want to be here anymore. In 2016, when intractable pain became an approved condition, my pain doctor encouraged me to be a part of the medical cannabis program. Only a month into using medical cannabis, my life began changing for the better. I am able to dose myself without feeling high, being fully functional, and reduce my daily pain dramatically. Cannabis also helps calm my anxiety, as well as control my traumatic brain injury and PTSD symptoms. Before cannabis, I was in a very dark place, and I felt like I had no future. To say medical cannabis improved my quality of life would be a vast understatement. Cannabis is the medicine I need to live a normal life. Unfortunately, all of this comes with a significant price tag. I pay $200 a year to be a part of the medical program and $400 to $500 a month. This cost is astronomical, unacceptable, and unattainable by most. My experience and situation motivates me to use my voice for patients that need access to cannabis medicine that is safe, effective, and affordable. I may not be here today if I did not have access to cannabis. It has allowed me to be a wife, mother, daughter, friend, and employee, as well as many other things in life.
I have to ask
other
you to
Minnesotans
wrap up, please.
Deserve the same access to this medicine as me. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Stefan Egan, and then Justa Deal. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And committee, thank you for having me. I'll keep it brief as most of the testifiers have already kind of laid out all the key points here. I retired from the Army and government service in 2015 after 10 years of active duty service, at which time up to that point I deployed 5 times with a total of 7 years in country in a combat theater environment. During my time served there, I experienced one gunshot wound to the chest and multiple TBIs due to concussions and explosions that we've experienced throughout those tours. I retired in 2015. In 2015, I was given the standard VA cocktail, tons and tons of opiates, tons and tons of sedatives, approximately 4,500 opiates annually over the course of 3 years, which essentially breaks down to about 12.5 high-potency opiate pills per day. With that came extensive dependency issues, as I'm sure you can imagine. And fortunate enough for me, I was able to visit farms in Colorado, in California, where I understood and learned to understand the benefits of plant nutrition, as I like to call it. Your body needs it. It functions with it better than it does without it. From those injuries I sustained, I had 6 open lesions on my brain, that were not capable of being healed by traditional medicines that were prescribed to me. Over the course of the next 5 years, all six of those lesions have healed, and I've gained total cognitive function back, so much so that I'm now the director of operations and director of research and development for a scientific applications company specific to cannabis. So for those that believe that cannabis is detrimental to the brain, I urge you to reconsider, for it's given me my brain and my life back and allows me to be a productive member of society and help move this industry forward in the direction that it needs to go. That's all.
Thank you so much. And I don't think you said your name for the record.
Stephan Egan.
Stephan Egan. Well, thank you, Mr. Egan. Appreciate it. Thank you very much for your service, and thank you for testifying today. Justin Deal and then George Realmuto. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, please don't be confused by my opening statements that I'm in the wrong chambers. According to data released by the CDC.
And please do state your name.
Justin Deal, licensed alcohol and drug counselor.
Thank
you. State
of
Minnesota. According to data released by the CDC, more than 1,100 Minnesotans died due to excessive drinking in 2021. This number is a record high for the state, representing a doubling of the mortality rate since 2014. Last year, more Minnesotans died of alcohol-induced causes than to homicide and suicide combined. These numbers notably do not include what the CDC considers indirect lethal consequences of alcohol abuse, like drunk driving, homicide, and other actions. This is by a substance that has been legal, again, for the last 90 years. However, one category of the so-called deaths of despair is increasing even more rapidly in Minnesota. Last year, 1,498 Minnesotans died due to drug overdose. I do not know a single solitary individual who met criteria for substance use disorder in any of the categories of cocaine, opiate, or hallucinogen that didn't report to first using marijuana, and I know thousands. With respect to how short a time we get to speak, I will just deeply implore you all to read our own Minnesota Department of Health findings in a brief review of human studies regarding increased risk of harm with cannabis use dated October 3rd, 2022. The Minnesota Psychiatric Society also released a study included in their report and certainly worth mentioning in today's chambers. One, despite early reports, cannabis use does not reduce prescribed or illicit opioid use or overdose use fatalities. Two, a greater dependence on tax-supported public welfare, unemployment, and drug treatment services. And three, increased prevalence of highway fatalities due to marijuana-impaired drivers after enactment of marijuana legalization. Our governor was initially on the record at the beginning of the pandemic that he was going to shut down liquor stores as non-essential. As an alcohol and drug counselor, I called and left a voice message with him, and I wanted a drastic mistake that he was about to make and how many thousands of Minnesotans that would have sent into alcohol withdrawal. If you do not think that an individual experiences both psychological and physical withdrawal from marijuana, you are greatly mistaken.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. George Realmuto, followed by John Layden. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative Liebling and Representative Bierman. George Realmuto, Professor Emeritus, Department of Psychiatry, University of Minnesota. My first experience with the harms of cannabis was in 1971. When my medical school friend and classmate jumped to his death from the roof of the basic science building. He progressed to this terminal phase by using every day and graduating to high potency THC concentrates. Since that time, I lost my daughter, and in this room are two other families who lost their children to cannabis mental health illnesses. When some say that cannabis is not lethal, that's hurtful to us, it's callous, and it's wrong. Cannabis psychosis is due to alterations in the endocannabinoid system, whose job it is to regulate the space between nerve cells, and is due to the toxic effect of THC on this space. The developing brain is vulnerable to stimulation by THC. This is the science. Protecting the developing brain is most important. This health committee should set the legal age at 25, when the brain is most mature. But at the very least, you must require the packaging material to say this product should not be used by people under 25. I know this won't be popular, but this is the Health Committee's responsibility. My second scientific point is potency. The higher the potency, the greater the synaptic damage. Please refer to my handout I sent you. A safe potency may be 15% potency found in the average dose of the medical cannabis program. We do not need Everclear cannabis. You can't leave this question to the cannabis board. Why would you think the board, with multiple agendas, will come up with a safe cap? Finally, I agree with funding the School of Public Health for data collection on the population effects of cannabis. Then go one step further. The war on drugs created so much stigma around addiction and the addict that we need a sea change in our thinking. We must have an ambitious and well-funded public health and early intervention program starting with secondary school students to teach them how to manage addictive stimuli, including cell phone usage and what? Social media.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. John Hausladen and followed by Jason Tarasek. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. I'm John Hausladen, president of the Minnesota Trucking Association, here speaking for us and Minnesotans Against Marijuana Legalization, an organization of business and civic groups. I want to thank the chief author for meeting with us and working on some of our concerns, and we continue to work on them. But until we're there, we still oppose the bill. And we want to speak today on workforce impacts on fiscal note. The interplay between human services, health, and workplace are tight. We talk about this today as if these are individual decisions that don't go beyond an individual's sphere of living. And the truth is, it affects workplace. The trucking industry are essentially business on wheels. These are workplaces. They're regulated by federal DOT drug testing. And we know from experience that people do pop positive. The path to get back and have that job is rigorous. You do have to go through substance abuse counseling. You do have to engage a medical provider. And that bill is borne by the employee. Our concern today is to make sure that this bill, if it goes forward, has enough funding to address the mental health and medical interventions that are going to be needed. It will increase. And it won't be just for trucking. It'll be for every DOT mode, air, rail, barge, school bus, transit driver. And these will expand beyond DOT-regulated industries to those that are just general employers. I also want to talk about fiscal impact. And I urge you, as you do the math on this, because we continue to wait for the numbers to come out, to look at what the experience is. Colorado has data showing that for every dollar collected in taxes, they're spending $4.50 on system-wide costs. We ask the fiscal note to consider not only direct costs, but the indirect costs that have been cited here today already. And I would conclude by saying we need to learn the lessons. The experts are here. The data is here. What is the rush? What is the lessons from other states that we need to do and do this right if we're going to do it? Have we learned anything from big tobacco and what it did to target youth and what it does to lead to workforce impacts? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Jason Tarasek followed by Jacob Meerman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is Jason Tarasek. I'm a cannabis attorney with Minnesota Cannabis Law. I urge you to vote in favor of House File 100. It is a well-crafted bill that will be a model for the nation. I am concerned, however, that as drafted, it might lead to the demise of Minnesota's medical cannabis program. We anticipate that the tax rate associated with adult-use marijuana products will be very low. That's a smart public policy measure necessary to put the illicit illicit market out of business. Even if we make medical cannabis tax-free for patients, however, the comparatively low taxes for adult-use marijuana might lead many patients to simply self-medicate rather than jump through the hoops of the medical cannabis program. There are currently more than 40,000 Minnesotans in the medical cannabis program, and even after we legalize adult-use marijuana, many of those patients would continue to benefit from consultations with cannabis pharmacists who tailor their medicine to their ailment. Additionally, if the medical program ceases to exist, children would no longer have access to their medicine. When I first got into this business, I was dubious about the benefits of medical marijuana. That is no longer true. I have seen that medical marijuana is real medicine, and it often has profound impacts on patients' lives. Something so simple as incentivizing licensed applicants to pledge to serve the medical market while also serving the adult use market might do the trick and might save the medical program. I look forward to continuing to work with Representative Stevenson and the Men Is Ready Coalition to tailor this bill to protect the medical program. Thank you for supporting House File 100.
Thank you for your testimony. Jacob Meerman, Dr. Jacob Meerman, and then followed by Leanne White. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Dr. Jacob Meerman. I'm a medical director of Life Medical in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. I'm here to testify in favor of the bill. I support adult use legalization because of all the drugs available for people's entertainment, both legal or not. Cannabis appears to be the safest. It's much safer than alcohol and tobacco, not even speaking of cocaine and opioids. Nonetheless, as a physician, I don't generally support using any drugs for fun, including cannabis. I certify patients for medical cannabis. I've certified around 4,000 people since 2015. I see everybody in follow-ups, and the result of treatments are very good. Side effects are rare and usually mild. The majority of my cases are with chronic pain, PTSD, and sleep apnea, but all the other qualifying conditions are also represented. This is one of the most useful drugs I know. It helps in many different conditions. It relieves pain, helps people sleep better, relieves anxiety, improves people's lives. One of the most surprising results for me was in kids with autistic disorders who improve remarkably on medical cannabis, including much better ability to learn and perform in school. I've seen their grades go from C's to A's. For this reason, we must make sure the medical cannabis program is preserved. In my experience, for the program to work for patients, proper medical oversight is necessary. The pharmacists at the cannabis dispensaries do this here. There are many cannabis products, and patients respond to them in different ways. Individualized approach is essential for good outcome of treatment. The pharmacists know how to manage and optimize it. I tell all my patients to work with the pharmacists closely to figure out what works best for them. Those patients who listen to this advice get the best results. I'm very concerned that if this bill passes as written, that this medical oversight may actually go away due to lack of funds. We must make sure this does not happen and there's money available to keep it in place. One way is to use some of the money from cannabis taxation to fund the pharmacist, but that's up to you to decide.
All right. I have to ask you Thank to wrap you. Up. Thank you so much for your testimony. Leanne White and then Jerry Rouser.
Hi. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Leanne White. I live in Northeast Minneapolis. I am a cannabis patient and have been since 2017. I ended up being a cannabis patient because I was bit by a tick in 2011 on a camping trip and ended up with late stage Lyme that was left undiagnosed and untreated for almost a decade. I now have permanent nerve damage. I deal with non-epileptic seizures. I have uncontrollable involuntary muscle movement and severe pain. At the height of my treatment for this undiagnosed illness, my family's out-of-pocket expenses were over $40,000. And the medications that were given to me to treat my severe disabling pain actually caused me to be in worse pain because it is contraindicated for the undiagnosed illness I have called mast cell activation syndrome. So I ended up in even more pain until I was successfully treated with cannabis. I now medicate every day. I use high THC cannabis to function. It has been a godsend. I am thankful every day. My children now have a capable mother. I am able to give back to my community. I am now a case manager for a social services organization in the western suburbs of Minnesota. It's a job I love, but had I not been given cannabis to be able to just exist and function, I don't think I would be alive. There's no way you can live with the kind of pain I did. I ask you to continue to support the medical cannabis organization that's in Minnesota and continue to allow people to recover. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And Jerry Rouser? Okay, so he's not here. Okay, is there anyone else from the public would like to testify? Come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Yes, thank you, Rep. Liebling, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Tom Evenstad, E-V-E-N-S-T-A-D. And I was a testifier at the only medical cannabis bill in 2014 with Rep. Moline's bill. And I'm here today in support of the bill. If I won the lottery and I got $50 million, I could lease a fleet of semi-trailer trucks, and I could buy out $50 million worth of alcohol. I could buy MGM, and I'd have enough poison, which is what ethyl alcohol is, to kill everybody in a medium-sized city. As far as the talk about the medical cannabis program, I've been a patient in it since 2014, and this bill does not end it. It doesn't kill it. It makes it better. The medical cannabis program, as other people have testified, is inordinately expensive. I am right now without my meds because I don't have the $150 for the state, based on a lot of reasons I'm not going to get into right now. But I want to assuage everyone's concerns about if the medical cannabis, even if it did sunset. I was forced to go to Michigan to get my medication. And in Michigan, dispensaries, you have a legal rec side, adult use like we're talking about, and then you have the medical side. It's the same thing. So in other words, when I needed my PTSD medication, if I had a better deal over on the medical side, price-wise, because that's what always drives me, I would buy the cheapest medical on the medical side. But I could also go online from Minnesota here and go to my Michigan dispensaries, and then I could go to the recreational side, which is what we are, again, talking about today. And then on the recreational side, even if there is no medical program, which I want to keep a medical program. The people are right. There should be doctors and people helping people along the way. But my point is, cannabis is cannabis. Every single person in this room, every mammal on earth, God put an endocannabinoid system in our brains, in our all kinds of different systems that we have within us, so we function better on cannabis. And then finally, I want to say that the prohibition of cannabis is rooted in. Thank you. It's rooted in racism. So I'm just asking people to please support the bill. Thank you, Rep. Liebling. Thank everyone.
So we're going to move to amendments. So I'm going to move the A51 amendment, representatives. I'm sorry, but you know we actually had people sign up for the bill, and we have to move on. Representative Stevenson, so the A51 is moved, and so this is the amendment that came from local public health that Carrie Evenstad was mentioning when she was up at the table, and I wonder if she would come back. And so this amendment, I've shared it with Chair Stevenson and Ms. Oldenfield. Do you want to just mention anything in particular about this? I know this relates to what you mentioned in your previous testimony, that you want to have more input by local public health. And could you just speak to that really briefly?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this amendment does a few things. It adds a local public health seat to the advisory council to have that dedicated youth prevention focused voice on the council. It sets the stage for a future appropriation for funding to local public health to be able to do that on the ground, community youth prevention, safe use, and then it also allows us to collaborate with MDH on their development of educational materials so that we can give that on the ground perspective since we'll be disseminating those materials.
All right, thank you. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the good conversation we've had about this amendment. As we've discussed, the plan from my perspective is to incorporate this in the next author's amendment to ease the burden on our nonpartisan staff, but I think it's a good amendment that I support. I also appreciate you leaving the appropriations blank for now, as we're still waiting for a fiscal note that we hopefully will have soon so we can determine the amount of funding that we have. But I will include this in my next author's amendment.
All right. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. So maybe we could just say a word about the blanks in the amendment. So could you just kind of describe your plan for that so that we can just have it on the record here and all understand?
Absolutely. I understood that the amendment, as I initially saw it, asked for $10 million total in funding. It was broken down, I think, $9 million in paragraph F, starting 1.15, and $1 million on paragraph G. But if I'm mistaken, we can certainly talk about that. Sounds like I got it right. The issue is just I'm resisting adding any more appropriations to the bill until we know what the fiscal note says, just to make sure the bill is self-sufficient and we have the appropriate balance of revenue and cost. That should happen very soon.
Okay, thank you. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for that explanation. Can you just give us an idea, since you're waiting to... When you talk about this balance between appropriations and tax revenue, is there something specific you're looking for? Are you hoping that the tax revenue will cover the appropriations? What are you specifically looking for in that decision-making process?
Representative Stevenson.
Chair Liebling, Representative New Brindley. Yeah, the bill needs to support itself, for starters. All appropriations of the bill need to be offset by the tax revenue the bill generates. That's my view of how this bill should operate. I don't expect that to be a problem for this appropriation. I've just established sort of a blanket rule that I'm not adding any more spending to the bill. So it's not even really about this appropriation in specific. It's just there, as you would probably imagine, there are a lot of people who would like appropriations out of this bill. And so we're holding them all off until we know how much money we have and how much money we've already spent.
Okay. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for that explanation. I hope that as you move forward and consider these appropriations, it's these kinds of appropriations, things regarding health, specifically public safety. I hope that if your goal is indeed to ensure that the tax revenue covers all of the appropriations in the bill, if there are things that must drop from your bill, I hope that there will continue to be a focus on health and public safety. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. That I would second that to Chair Stevenson. I think he's well aware that many members share that view. So other discussion to this amendment? All right, seeing none, I'm going to withdraw the amendment then on the commitment of Chair Stevenson that he's going to incorporate this at a later stop. There are two other amendments in the packet. There's A52 amendment. Does someone want to offer that? Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A52 amendment.
All right. So moved. To your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And in fact, thank you to Dr. Realmuto and to Mr. Mayberry for their comments. And specific to the potency cap on within the bill, this amendment would create a potency cap of 35%, and I'm actually hoping that Mr. Johnson would be willing to explain to us the total THC term, that term.
Well, we're a little bit short on time. I don't know, who's Mr. Johnson, sir? Oh, Mr. Johnson, House Research. Sorry, I thought you were calling for another testifier. Sure, Mr. Johnson. There are a lot of Johnsons in Minnesota.
It's true. Madam Chair, members, Ben Johnson from House Research. I'm going to do this at a pretty high level, so hopefully the experts in the audience won't criticize me. But in general, the psychoactive component of marijuana or cannabis is Delta-9 THC. However, when it exists in the plant form, it typically is in a different form. It is in a form that is known as tetrahydrocannabinolic acid, which is usually referred to as THCA. The THCA converts to Delta-9 when heat is applied to it, so that's generally what happens when individuals are smoking the plant material. The heat gets applied to it, it goes through a process called decarboxylation and turns into Delta-9 when it is inhaled. And so what this bill does is it uses the total THC, which includes any Delta-9 THC in the plant, plus a percentage of the THCA that is generally accepted in the community as the percentage that gets transformed into Delta-9 during that decarboxylation process.
Okay, Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Johnson, for the explanation. It's a little bit more complicated than I thought I should take a stab at. But I do think that's important to understand what we're talking about when referring to this amendment specifically and the cap. So this amendment would cap the total THC in the flower. It would be 35% total THC, and concentrates would be capped at 60% total THC. Frankly, this is an area where we should learn from other states. Vermont put in place a potency cap, and frankly, Washington State did not. And they are now, they've got bills moving through their legislature now to add a cap that they didn't have in place to begin with. They now see the importance of having a cap in place when they did not do that initially. Now, the average potency of adult use flower ranges from 15 to 25%, which is actually lower than the cap that I am proposing, where a reasonable cap would come into play. However, we saw in Colorado, specifically between 1995 and 2015, there has been a 212% increase in the THC content in flower. So it does matter. While the average potency would fall under this cap, there are significant increases in what we see for THC content in flower, which is why I'm proposing we add the cap now rather than making the mistake that Colorado made, that Washington State made, where they're now trying to dial that back and add that cap. So I would ask for member support on the A52 amendment.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, I'll just start by saying that I'm happy to talk to you more about this offline and have a discussion about this. As you may have heard from a testifier, there's a concept out there that I'm exploring about giving the agency some ability to do this through rulemaking in a more specific way that would be tailored to specific products. I'm not totally sold on yet, but I'm interested in it. I would just note a few things. One, most states do not have a potency cap of any kind. There is no potency cap on alcohol in Minnesota or anywhere else that I'm aware of. We're treating the substance differently than that. Most vapes, almost all vapes, are at 85%. So this bill would functionally make most vapes not available in Minnesota, which would be a great boon to the illicit marketplace. I think this amendment, as drafted, is not workable and undercuts the purpose of the bill. But I understand the concern and the issue, and I'm happy to continue the conversation. But today, I would ask for a no vote.
Okay. Any further discussion on the amendment? All right. Representative New Brindley, I don't know if you we're not going to just sit and debate it, but go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just add, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for your consideration in considering the concept moving forward. I would echo what Dr. Realmuto said, that it does not make sense to leave caps to the board. So caps could still be in place. The board could put these in place. That seems an irresponsible move as a legislature to abdicate that responsibility and give that to the board. And I would just say, you know, the Missouri Medicine Journal in 2018, they put out a study, and they talked about the prefrontal motor cortex, which is the seat of judgment in our brains. This is where we exercise judgment, and it's the last to fully develop. It can take 25 to 30 years to fully develop. And that's where, you know, during these ages, we've got a lot of learning going on, exploring, doing. And these high-potency products, they create impulse problems, impulse control, judgment problems that are absolutely a matter of public health. And we need to take it very seriously. And so while I hope that you are sincere in your willingness to move to work on this moving forward, we absolutely must consider the effects that this will have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, so members, I would just say that I hope that I'm going to recommend that members vote no for the time being, but I think it's another issue that is a good discussion, a good thing for Chair Stevenson to consider as the bill moves forward. So with that, all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. To the A 53. And let me just say, we are obviously going over a little bit. We have authorization to continue for a few more minutes so we can get through the bill. So is someone offering the...
Yeah, Madam Chair, I am.
Okay, Representative Backer.
Members, this amendment would require a warning label that states that the product is not recommended for individuals under 25. We heard some very powerful testimonies. We know for a fact that brains do not develop, fully develop until age 25. This amendment also would also require the office to study for the medical and science literature on the effects brain development has for individuals under 25. It is prudent for us here to study this. I do not serve as an EMT for just by will. I am called to help the patients. We are also called to protect young people all people in the roles that we play here, but especially young people need to be the voice. We heard some very tragic testimonies today. The one gentleman with his daughter, I could not do that type of testimony if it was my daughter. I text her during this. That's such a powerful. We had the gentleman with the two adopted sons, Jay, testify. We know from research reports from the National Institute of Drug Abuse that there is evidence in several studies that indicates that exposure of marijuana during these development times in people's life can cause long-term permanent challenges in the brain. We heard testifiers against that. We also heard in the prior amendment that, and we should learn from our what we've seen with opioids. We know, and we have had members that have had children that has been affected by that drug, that there's specifically prefrontal motor cortex that cannot take, that takes longer for development. And I know the argument, well, is they can drink, they can take marijuana. That's a poor argument, okay? If I can speed, that's the same argument in my opinion. If I can speed on fast roads, I can speed on ice roads. Old roads that are icy, they're two different things. They affect us differently. I've been on runs that see what the effect of marijuana has and effect of alcohol. So I would really ask that the members support the A53 amendment. It puts guardrails, reasonable guardrails that we heard that parents want, testifiers want, and so forth. So I would ask members to support the A53 amendment. And thank you, Madam Chair, and for that.
Representative Backer. Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Backer. So here's what I'm going to suggest for this amendment. We had a similar amendment in the Commerce Committee that Representative New Brindley offered as to pregnant women and breastfeeding mothers. And what we did was he incorporated that. Actually, you're amending that language in Subdivision 6 of Section 58 of the bill, starting on line 110, to require the office to do a health and safety review of scientific literature and require a warning label as appropriate. And in fact, your amendment lines 1.12 and 1.13 add the discussion of whether how it impacts brain development under 25 to that section and would potentially result in the office requiring such labeling if it's supported by scientific data. I don't support writing into law what the label should say, but I do support giving the agency the direction to look at this issue and put a label on it if it's supported by the scientific research that they determine. So in my next author's amendment, I will commit to you to take the lines 1.12 and 1.13, but I don't support the rest of the amendment, so I'm going to ask for a no vote today.
All right. Other discussion to the amendment? Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Backer. And I would just ask Representative Stevenson to reconsider, well, the committee to reconsider, because they actually get to vote on it. The brain development is well documented. We understand that 25 really is a critical age. This is not really up for debate. And certainly, I would hope that members of this committee who are voting on this bill and voting on this language have looked into that and understand the importance of sort of age 25 when it comes to brain development. This amendment does not prohibit purchase. It does not prohibit use before age 25. This particular amendment is a really good compromise to ensure that the public understands what can happen and that there are risks associated with use before the age of 25. And I would hope that folks would understand that, would understand the literature on this, and vote yes.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you looked at the written testimony submitted, there was a large portion that covered this age 25 and youth and et cetera. One of the testifiers, an ER physician, said he wasn't seeing the problems, but part of that's because Minnesota doesn't have legalized. And if you look at Colorado and the effects on youth admissions to the emergency department, ERs, gone up dramatically, and there's an issue. And frankly, this amendment at least would assist with that. Thank you.
All right, Representative Backer.
Yeah, and real quick, and I appreciate that the Representative Stevenson's. We have warning labels on tobacco and other products. This just makes sense. So I would ask for a yes vote. Thank you.
All right. So I would just say that I'm going to recommend a no vote. Again, I think this is not a bad thought and certainly something I hope Chair Stevenson will consider as he moves forward, perhaps the way he's described. But I would just say, comment that it's not only whether there's an impact on health, it's also the effectiveness of a label and how much goes on the label and whether it's going to be actually read by anyone is kind of important as well. So I think there's more to think about here than just that. So all in favor of adoption of the A53, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. So with that, we're going to turn to the bill. And is there any further discussion to the bill? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you look closely, about half of the testifiers that testified for the bill were medical cannabis users. And with existing, the big point was the cost. This bill is not guaranteeing the quality and consistency of dosage on the recreational market. And so that if we have people that are skipping the medical and going the recreational, I think there's a quality and a consistency thing that we have to keep in mind. I don't want to shoot the medical marijuana area in the foot by doing an incomplete bill, and I don't think this bill is addressing the issues appropriately, and there will be unintended consequences in our medical marijuana scape.
All right, thank you. All right, seeing no further. Representative Schumacher, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stevenson. Just a couple of questions on the appropriation piece in the Department of Health. There's the $277,000 and $330,000 that it's appropriated for data collection reports. I'm wondering if you can tell us what those reports are. I wasn't able to find those. I thought maybe they'd be in Section 4, but I couldn't find them there. And then the Department of Health, the Minnesota Poison Control System, the $500,000 for that. What is that to be used for? And then how did these amounts get into the bill?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, I'm going to address the poison control one and then ask Mr. Johnson if he can help us tie the 277 back in the bill. The poison control is for additional staffing and updates that they need. We have one poison control center for the entire state of Minnesota and you know, other states, include actually this would be a conversation to have in more detail offline, but there's been a big spike in cannabis consumption by minors, including in Minnesota. In fact, we outpace Colorado for the last 2 years in cannabis exposure by young people. And so it's to give them additional capacity to make sure that we're getting the correct information to parents and dealing with the health consequences of cannabis exposure for young people.
Yeah.
But Mr. Johnson might know the 277.
Okay. Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Ben Johnson again from House Research. There are a variety of reports that the office needs to perform, and I believe that in Section 1, some of those are in consultation with the Department of Health. There is also an education program that's in Article 6. It's Article 6, Section 6. Excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm on the wrong section. It's Article, which report is it? There we go. It's Article 6, Section 7. There's cannabis data collection and biennial reports by the Department of Health. That's page 196. It begins at line 28.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 100 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Correct? Public Safety. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No. No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to public safety. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. With that, we are adjourned.